So if you have a particular rule that you need to make public, the best thing to do is bury it. I know this sounds crazy, but put it next to the function you're talking about. If you have some rules and regulations about upload and download, you have to scroll it across the screen whether they see it or not. Put it in there where the download area is. They might look at it then. If it's buried with the other 23 things, they're never going to see it. The same way in a message area. If you have something you want them to know about dealing with the messages, put it close to the messages or where when they go into the message area, they would see it.
Very best in that case is if you can blend it with instruction that they want. Teaching them how to use your system and sort of letting the rule happen during the explanation that they want to read because they want to upload or they want to download or they want to do the messages. You've got the motivation that way. If you put the rule in more or less as a guideline of how to use the system as opposed to looking like you're going to draw the six gun and pop them one if they violate it, they're much more likely to absorb it. All of these things, and we're spending an awful lot of time on them because, frankly, in our experience, these are the areas people mess up routinely and take a system that ought to work and make it not work. And in many cases, simple reorientation of your thought along these lines is all it takes to turn your BBS from marginal to making money. If you've gone that far with it, this may be the only piece you're missing. Remember, if you possibly can, what it was like when you first got your modem. Remember what you felt like when you first dialed a BBS. It was pretty sweaty in the armpits. You were just sure. You had no idea what you were doing. You were already terribly afraid you were going to break someone else's computer
and get in trouble.
Get in trouble, so you're already conditioned for the concept that you're about to do a bad thing. Now, I cannot tell you why, but it's human psychology. When I first called bulletin boards, when everybody I know first called bulletin boards, I've never met anyone who didn't feel exactly this way the first time that they made their first call to a remote system. Remember, that's your customer. That's the mindset he's in. You want to take him out of that mindset and tell him he's found a nice place. A little money will make it even nicer, especially if he sends it to you. And you've just got to keep that in mind. And so the first thing you do when you're calling to break someone's computer and you just know it, you're scared you're going to do the wrong thing. And the first thing that jumps out is three pages of don't do this, don't do that. And you don't even know what the this's and that's are. But you already know you're about to do the wrong thing, and you've just been told you probably already have.
And we're going to get you. What we're saying in a roundabout way, what this works down to is a concept that I think is pretty important for anyone who's going to do it. Most people who start businesses or are told to do a business plan, it's really directed at the same thing. In order to have a theme, an identifiable theme, and know who your audience is, to develop this tone, basically you need to sit down and in 25 words or less, tell yourself, write it down on a piece of paper, why it is you're running a bulletin board system, essentially a mission statement, because it's going to color what kind of tone you have, what kind of theme you develop, what your target audience is. The choice of the software you use for that bulletin board system is all going to come out of that mission statement. And what does a mission statement look like? Bob Mahoney, I'm going to quote him because I think he's a pretty bright fellow and he runs a bulletin board system that does quite well, is that you need a more complex set of goals to make money with a bulletin board system than either running a bulletin board system or making money. You have to have a reason, some direction that you want to accomplish in your life by running a bulletin board system. Now that might be to advance the cause of the rights of animals. It might just be to provide, you know, the best technical forum for Pascal programmers in the world. It might just be to have the most well cataloged, well described, and best maintained shareware library collection in the country. It might be to advance the cause in some political direction. But generally, people who have a mission statement, who are headed somewhere, find it much easier to develop the theme that they can be identified with, the tone that their callers will relate to, and almost everything, right down to technical decisions and considerations in operating the system, if they know why they want to run the system on its own. We're past the stage where bulletin boards are experimental. It is no longer remarkable that you run a bulletin board system. It's at this point, and it's, I'm very pleased to report this, having been almost run out of the room a number of places 3 or 4 years ago to discuss the concept of making money with a bulletin board system, but it's not even today that remarkable to make money with a bulletin board system. So it's time to start focusing on what it is you want to accomplish, what happened to the world because you ran a bulletin board system, and draw all the lines to theme, tone, audience, and where you're headed there from that mission statement. It can appear pretty general when you do it the first time, but almost everything will fall out of that you go from there.
Once you've developed your theme, now you're ready to move on and start to put together your plan, your process. Now, the best plans are ones that you take at least an afternoon and think through almost all the steps in, but you really don't even need to do it that thoroughly, because if you have a theme and you have a vision, you have a guidepost for every move you make. That's why we focus so long here on theme, on outlook. Put yourself in the position of your caller. What do you want your caller to think of you and your BBS when they first contact you? What image do you want their mind to form? What thoughts do you want them to get in their first 30 seconds, in their first minute, when they contact your BBS? What do you want them to see? What do you want them to think? What do you want them to feel? If you know those things, then it becomes much easier to begin to construct the mechanism to produce them. If you don't know those things, you're only going to construct a successful mechanism by accident. And it does happen, but it's much less likely to succeed than if you have that vision. Once you have that vision, you now also can begin to see some of the next steps. They almost become obvious and logical once you've seen what you're trying to do. You're trying to make that caller touch your system and feel a response. You want that customer to know that you stand out from the crowd, as Jack said, from the currently 40,000, soon to be 80 or 100,000 bulletin boards that he has to choose from. You want him, if he hits yours, to stick. One of the most effective ways, the most effective ways to make that happen is print follow-up. Cannot emphasize enough. You'd think in an electronic medium that paper would be unimportant. Actually, in an electronic medium, paper is more important than ever. Nothing is more magic than I called a phone number, popped this BBS, got a feeling. I probably called a half dozen that night. That's the way it works if you go out exploring. If 3 or 4 days later your mailbox pops out a piece of paper that says, "Thank you for calling this BBS. We really appreciate your being here. We hope you call back. Here's some nice imagery in print. Here's some thoughts about our theme. Here's a little discussion. I'm sure you didn't have time to tour our BBS. Here's a list of all the things that are on it." Now you've got a second touch, and the guy has something to hang on to. It's going to go on his desk. He's going to look at it 3-4 times a day. It might even take a month, but you guarantee you're going to get another call out of it.
Yeah, there are a couple of reasons why this works. Number one is most people don't dial a BBS, and certainly not a new BBS. As Phil said, they'll pick out, go through this list of several hundred bulletin board systems, and pick out 4 or 5 that they want to dial. So they dial through the 4 or 5 systems in an evening, and they go to bed. Half the time, and I dial as many bulletin boards as anyone on the planet, when they wake up the next day, they can't remember which one of the bulletin board systems such and such was on. One of them made a very favorable impression, and he makes a note to call it again, but he wrote down the wrong one. There's any number of things that can happen there. When you do a print follow-up, the other function that gets addressed is that screen that they're looking at with the technology we have today is typically 24 lines long and 80 columns wide. It operates at about 2400 BPS, in some cases a bit more than that. But if you have 80 or 90 or 100 menus, they're not going to see them all. It's a fairly narrow window on what it is you have on your system. They're looking at it through a pipe, through a manhole. When there's something about print that you can put a list of 200 message conferences and all the different topics that you cover on there on a piece of paper, it's not limited to 80 columns and it's not limited to 24 lines. On a fairly simple direct mail piece, you can list several hundred topical message areas, 80 or 100 file download areas, a little paragraph of background. Why did Norm Hinkey started a bulletin board system? He came home one day, there it was, it was run it or get rid of it. What's his wife think about that? So on a piece of paper, you can give a lot more information, a wider window and a taller window as to what they contacted in this cyberspace. The other thing you can do is put their logon name, password, and your telephone number on it, so they can get back in on the same account. It's in their hand. It's either throw it in the wastebasket or put it on the desk, if I might call it later. And frankly, it's come down to some days stories have gotten into BoardWatch because there was a card sitting there. It had the phone number. It was easy to get on, and it looked like it had some sort of a theme that would make a story. It happened to be on the desk, and I needed 8 column inches. That's how cavalier and how casual your initial contact is with these callers. You have no relationship. They're not your buddy. They don't know you. You're one out of many, many bulletin boards. They've gone a step toward you by dialing you, and now with this print follow-up function, you can cement that a little bit to get them back in a second time.
The other thing print follow-up does is it gives you a chance to be very visual with your theme. Graphics are getting better on bulletin boards, but even pretty startling ANSI graphics are a very primitive way to convey an image. They, again, are limited to the technology of the screen. They're limited in all those ways. If your theme has any element that's visual to it, let's say you run a bulletin board about birds, for instance, you can do some things graphically in ANSI with birds, but you're not going to really ever draw a picture of a cockatoo that's going to look like one. On the other hand, your print follow-up could have some just gorgeous pictures in it that's going to get anyone who cares about birds interested. And it's going to show up after they called your bulletin board. It's going to remind them. It's going to have their name on it, their logon, their password. If you want to really go whole hog, say they've got 15 more free minutes to come back and look again. You want to get them back 2 to 3 times. If you get them back 2 to 3 times, unless you run them off, you'll probably get a subscription. Because by the time they've called you the third time, there's something you're doing that they think they're interested in. If your subscription is easy for them to give to you, now they're going to say, what the heck, it's only $15, $25. It's time. I'll do that. I'll go on.
The other thing we keep hammering on theme, but it's something, let's relate it a little bit to the real world. Let me tell you why it's more important online than it is in the real world. There's a lot of hamburgers out there. I've eaten most of them. I've paid 59 cents for a hamburger and a Burger King across the street from a junior high school at lunchtime, and I really should have had the 30 cent refund when it was all done. I've spent $11 on a hamburger sitting in a red leather chair and a walnut table and a real nice quiet surroundings. It's the same hamburger. You can only grind cow so many ways. What's important here is the sense of place. Where was I when I ate the hamburger? Not that I ate a hamburger. online, you would think, and most of the common wisdom is that these sort of cues aren't necessary. We're all electronic people. We don't need that. It's actually more important. They're dialing 10 digits out of space. It's an ethereal place, and the natural human thing to want to do is find where you are in the universe. As soon as that other modem picks up, where am I, and what are its characteristics? So a number of things you can do on your bulletin board system. One of the objectives is to give them a sense of place. I dial bulletin board systems continuously. You get on them, 30 minutes later you get off, you don't know who ran them, you don't know why they ran them, and you don't even know where they're located unless you've got some place where you can look up an area code.
But you do know all the things you can do wrong.
Right, but you do know what you can do wrong. The more you can do to establish a sense of place, where it is, who you are, why you run a bulletin board system, and what the theme is, immediately gives you that walnut table, that red leather chair, and your caller a sense of where they are in cyberspace. Where they are in space has a great deal to do with whether they want to be there regularly or whether they want to keep on going down the road to somewhere else. So establishing this place and sense of space on a bulletin board system is very important. And if you look at the more successful systems, they all do it. One of them that does it as well as any place I've been is the Whole Earth Electronic Link out in Sausalito. They've got 7,500 subscribers today. They've gone through some technical challenges here in the last year, but it's a very well-regarded system. Many people like it and have a very solid sense of where they're at and who they're with. They also develop a sense of community there that I think is also important. But this sense of place and space, where you're at, is extremely important, and many of the things that you do on your bulletin board system can relate to this. Let's take that to a practical step, something I see bulletin board operators do a great deal. They watch their boards too closely, and they analyze those day files and those logs of what callers have done to death. And they'll take the things that people don't do on their bulletin board system and prune them off, because why have them? They take up disk space, they have to be maintained, and nobody's using it anyway. Well, if you follow that route to its logical conclusion over a period of about 10 years and study it very carefully, you wind up with a file directory with DOS shell programs in it.
An example of what Jack's talking about here to bring it really home. Let us say that on your bulletin board you're going to offer online games. You think that this is part of your image, that you want to be a fun place to be. You think your callers are really going to enjoy games. You put on 100 different games. Some of them are trivial, little tic-tac-toe kind of games. You can play them 3 times before you're tired of them. Others of them are online intellectual logic games that you can play for life and only get halfway through, and you've got everything in between. You put this up, your callers call, you get a great response, and you analyze this for a month, and you discover that out of this 100 games you put up, only 4 games are ever played, and the rest of them just sit there. So you take the other 96 off.
Lots of extra disk space now.
Lots of extra disk space. You get rid of those menus. You're ready to go now and put on something else they want. What is going to be their impression when they call back next time? You took all my games away. Even though they're never playing them, they feel comfort that they have that many to choose from. The same is true if you run a file download system. I'm sure some of you here, I know, run huge file download systems, and if you analyze your system, less than 5 to 10% of your files account for 90% of your downloads, without doubt. Would it be intelligent to take the other 90% of your files off? No, because every new caller gets a tremendous reassurance out of spending an hour just listing the names of all your files.
There's lots of DOS shells there.
There's a lot of DOS shells. There's more here than I could ever download or ever would want to, and I feel good that I'm here.
And the point is that they established a sense of place by having the 100 games. You dialed into the games bulletin board system. That's where they have all the games, and they're probably going to have all the latest games. And any new games, if they've got 100 up, there's no reason to expect that they wouldn't add any new ones there. So by having the 100, you establish a sense of place, an identity, a theme, the whole thing. They know where they're at. Yes, they're all in the same four games. That's what they do, but that's not where they're at. So a lot of things on a bulletin board system are not there specifically because callers demand to do them each day. They contribute to the sense of space and the image they have of where they're at when they land on that system in cyberspace. I can't stress it strongly enough that those kind of cues, where am I and why am I here, are extremely important to a sense of people wanting to belong to something. And that's where you get into subscriptions. So that sense of place is extremely important.
The next thing, of course, is once you've made a comfortable place for callers to touch, once you've got print follow-up going to make them want to call back, once you've gotten them to call back the second or the third time and want to join, the next thing is don't make it hard for them to give you money. That's the next mistake we see made incredibly often. That binding, which has taken place, although it's gotten pretty strong by the third call and people are really interested, can go away real fast. Like if you make him put something in an envelope with a stamp on it and send it to you. That's a lot of work, and enough work to break the cycle that's been going on that's drawing him in. You need to make it so that you can take his money as easily as you possibly can. If he really wants to send you a check in the mail, you of course want him to have that opportunity, and you instantly want him to know the address to send it to. But you also want to take that money the way he probably really wants to give it to you, is take a credit card number. Type in a credit card number, an expiration date, and go. Secondly, when he gives you a credit card number, take his word for it. Don't tell him, I know you're a crook and gave me a bogus credit card number, and until 3 days clearance at the bank, I'm not letting you on anyway. He's warm. He gave you a credit card number. A certain percentage of people will give you bad numbers. Most don't. What are you out? If you let him on, he runs up 25 minutes a time, 3 hours a time, 10 hours a time on your system. You find out his credit card's bad and you shut him off. What have you lost?
3-4 DOS shell programs.
That's it. If, on the other hand, when you get him all warmed up, he gives you a credit card number, you say, fine, come back a week from Tuesday after we've checked this all out, you've probably lost a lot. He's probably going to say no thanks. So make it as easy as possible for him to take the money.
I hate to interrupt. Is there a James Willing here? James Willing? Anyone knows James Willing? He needs to return... report to the registration desk. There's some sort of family emergency. He did.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
The bulletin board system is basically an electronic medium. People are doing things right now, and they're doing it with their keyboards. The only means that we have reliably right now to transfer funds is these credit cards that Phil's talking about. There's about 180 million checking accounts in the country. About 93 million credit card accounts. People often will be willing to support you financially, but not so willing to give up time and effort to write out a check, figure out where to mail it, fill out any form that you might have, put it in an envelope and get it to you. If they do all that, you'll probably get a check from someone you don't know who. You don't know what account on the bulletin board system that they want it for, and it's really, to get them to go through that many steps is too much of an intrusion. I have nightmares of checks made out to Boardwatch magazine hanging on refrigerators all over the country, the little magnets with smiling faces on them, but I didn't get the check. So it is a matter of convenience. It's not just persuading them to support your system and your efforts and what you're doing in your mission. And that is basically the transaction here. It's also you need to take the burden of doing the transfer of funds.
Accepting credit cards is so important that you almost cannot make money with a bulletin board unless you can take credit cards. If you take credit cards and have even close to met the image, the appearance, and even, frankly, if you abuse callers, you can often still make money.
As long as you have DOS shell
programs. As long as you have DOS shell programs. And the right four games.
That's right. The function here is that these credit card numbers make it easy to happen and easy for them to do it. We've taken a look at some fairly hard numbers. I conservatively tell people that whatever you're taking in by checks, by cash, in grain, chickens, and fruit, you can multiply by a factor of four just by taking credit cards. Most sysops who run successful systems disagree with me. They'll tell you 90% of what they take in comes in on a MasterCard or Visa number. That's the numbers.
Question is, would that be with a door for Visa, MasterCard, or voice? The answer is it doesn't have to be with either. It can be as very simple as a questionnaire. Trust them on the number. Take it. Give them instant access. The next day, you pick it up and handle the credit card any way you can. And if one out of 100 of those credit card numbers is bad, you shut that guy off, you got the other 99. You really don't have to get super sophisticated about this. One of the problems that I see in an online community is we try to over-technology ourselves. We're so focused on being technically exactly correct, we forget why we were bothering. And the point here is to make it easy for someone to give you their money. That's the exact thing. How much will you lose if somebody gives you a bad credit card number for a subscription? You'll lose a few minutes of connect time. You've lost absolutely nothing. On the other hand, if you make it hard, if you make them wait while it dials for an authorization, if you make them do any of those things, you've made it harder for them to take their money. So the idea here is to make it as absolutely easy as you possibly can. Now the trick, of course, is to be able to take credit cards, you have to be able to clear credit card charges on your end. And here's the nub of what happens when you try to run a BBS for profit. You have to be able to clear credit cards, and a whole lot of bankers, when you go to them and say, I got an electronic service, people are going to give me credit card numbers over the phone, and I want you to clear them for me, look at you about like you're John Gotti or somebody.
You're Jeffrey Dahmer and you want to do what with my bank? Is basically the reaction here. They're not really singling bulletin board people out. In fact, you're getting a knee-jerk response because in most cases they don't know what a bulletin board is. The banks in this country have a bad problem right now. It has to do with credit cards and it has to do with fraud. The credit card networks that clear credit card numbers don't suffer any losses, ever. The banks that issue these accounts have to make good on any charges that are put out there. What happens is that if the bank maintains a merchant account for someone and they disappear and a number of chargebacks come from customers who are, their card has been charged and no one knows anything about it, is that they have no one to go to and the bank loses the amount of the funds. There have been banks shut down from this, have actually gone beat up over this credit card fraud thing, so they're very touchy about it. The other thing they're very touchy about is telephones. And the reason is a lot of the credit card fraud has come from telephone boiler room operations where they make outbound sales calls to sell $60 worth of office supplies for $900 and so forth because you get a pocket radio with it. They've had some very bad experiences with it. They don't know that you don't make outbound telephone calls. When you say the word telephone, they've got a problem, or perceive it they do. So the whole concept of online transactions to them brings this up. And you have to be able to explain this situation and present yourself to a bank, and that is still the best place to get a merchant account. A lot of people look for an easy fix with a third-party vendor or so forth. They go into the bank, contact the teller, ask her for a merchant account application, and when she tells them they don't do that, they go away and their bank won't handle them. You have to do a little bit of work up front with a business plan. It helps to have establish a relationship. You're basically asking for credit, a loan. And so you have to go through all the steps that are there. We do have a couple of people here at the, we consider this important enough that we went out and got a few people. Tim Pfeiffer from Teleflora will be here.
That's at 10 o'clock tomorrow, right? Or 10 o'clock Saturday, I guess.
Yeah, it's going to do a session on this. We've got a couple of them in a booth. Bill Lauder is here. He's going to do some of that as well. We've got people you can talk to about getting an account, places you can apply for an account, and software that will allow you to automate all this. But I would, in spite of that, urge you to try to do this with the bank where you already have a relationship. It's less expensive, it goes better, and in all ways, if you can get a merchant account at a local bank where you do business and they know you, you're going to be better off any way you cut it. We have some options here that are if that fails, but it's still the best way to go. And we consistently run into people who tell us, it can't be done, my bank said no, they said no 1,000 times, it's not going to happen, who've gone back and approached them with a rational business plan, put on a little bit of clothes, made an appointment, talked to someone who can make a decision there at the bank, and have turned those situations around. They're in all cases better off with that. We have another session, Simon Clement from the Garbage Dump Bulletin Board System, a 28-line board down in Albuquerque, actually, and they have a line up here to Denver, who went through all this and is going to share with us some of the important elements of putting together a business plan, applying for such a merchant account, and what people look for in judging you as a business that has to do directly with bulletin board systems.
Last year when we went through this same sort of structure, we found one of our number one responses was, you say I need a credit card, you say I need a business plan, you say I need all these things, I need to know how to do these things. So we've tried to put some sessions in this year which are specifically aimed at solving these problems because they are vitally important. On the other hand, as Jack says, you're really best off, this is a credit transaction, and as you go to brokers and you go away from a bank, you're going to people who are dealing with you even though you're riskier, and the way they're going to deal with that is they're going to up the rates they charge you. That's how credit works. The riskier the credit, the more it costs to get. So the best deal you'll get is with your bank, and the best way to get that is to realize that when you apply for a credit card merchant account, you're asking the banker to loan you the charges he pays you before the other person pays them into the bank. You're asking him to loan you that money for the duration of the float period. And as Jack said, it is the banker you deal with who is loaning you that money, and if any of it goes bad and can't be collected, it's that bank who suffers the loss. So it's a very direct credit transaction. How do you deal with credit applications at a bank? Your whole purpose in life when you talk to a banker about credit, and I don't care if it's a car loan or a credit card merchant account, you have to convince that banker he can trust you. That's the essence of the transaction. There isn't really a second part. As soon as he trusts you, he's going to make money off of you, and then he is happy to do business with you. That's his business. That's what he wants to do. But he's only making a certain percentage off of every transaction, and his job is to make sure he's not entering into deals that are too risky for that to pay off. So your whole purpose is to make him trust you. How do you do that? Make a very coherent presentation about what your enterprise is. It's an electronic bulletin board system. I wouldn't start there. I would start with some other words about the fact that you're starting a business in which people are purchasing services. Relate it to the sort of structure that a banker might understand. Then work backwards from that into the details of the business. The details of the business are that people are purchasing entertainment, because that's in essence what you're selling. And they're purchasing that entertainment on a subscription basis. And what you need in order to sell them entertainment is you need a credit card transaction so that when they purchase this entertainment, that you can make the transaction easy. Explain to them the background of the bulletin board industry, that there are many bulletin boards out there that are reputable. Build a case for why you're not in a fly-by-night business. And specifically, work to convince the banker that you personally are also trustworthy. As Jack said, your presentation, the way you look, get a haircut before you go, wash the night before. Do some simple things to make the person that's on the other end of the desk feel that you can be trusted with his money. That's what you're asking. It's a sales job. You have to sell him, the banker, that you can be trusted to hold his money and give it back with a little extra.
The other thing that I think comes from a lot of the engineering background a lot of the bulletin board operators have had is when bankers ask a question and when an engineer asks a question, we're in two completely different transactions here. If you ask an engineer where he lives, he starts with, well, it's a room and it has furniture and it's in a house and it's on a street and it has a tree on the street and there's a car next door. And that's in a suburb. It's actually, technically, it's a suburb of a suburb of a major metropolitan area, which happens to be St. Louis, Missouri. That's in the state of Missouri. Now, we're on the side there on the west side of the river, and the banker wants Missouri, right? If you ask an engineer a question, you start with the speed of light, and everything goes from there, and how it was created, who should get proper credit for it being created, and how it works. There is such a thing as too much information. I wouldn't withhold anything from a bank you're trying to establish a business relationship with. But understand when they ask a question that the entire history of bulletin board systems is not what he was asking. It was really, what's your address? And so you need to answer a little bit the question that was asked. This is a real common situation. If you overcome a banker with information about a technology, a market, a whole business he's never heard of and doesn't know anything about, you haven't engendered a lot of trust, common ground here, and an easy feeling that, oh yeah, I know what this is, and we can establish a relationship here.
When you explain to him what you're doing, you want to make him feel like it's something that he's comfortable with. And what you want to do is make it sound as much like other things he knows as you can. Not like something new and different. The words new and different scare bankers probably more than any other two words in the English language, because they like old and reliable. And they want to know that they can trust the process. Okay. We have found that although we're told routinely that you cannot get credit cards for... get merchant accounts to clear credit cards online, people are telling us every day that they just walked into their bank and did it. A lot of it does depend on where you live. If you're in Southern California, it's a lot tougher. But on the other hand, don't jump around it before you give it a try.
Yeah, it is 4 o'clock. I'd like us all to take a little bit of a break, get a cup of coffee or whatever. We're going to come back for the second half of this at 4:30 and continue, get into some hard numbers, a little bit about the follow-up sessions we have related to this, and take some questions and answers. But let's all get something to drink, take a break here for a few minutes.
All right, we're ready for the second half. Whoops. What was that? Did it
turn mine on?
You turned yours on? Let's try again.
All right.
Is it on now?
No.
He's just covering.
Huh?
He's adjusting. Okay. I'd like to address a couple of things people mentioned to me during the break. As usual, when we give these presentations, I'm always amazed by how many ways people discover during the break that none of this can work. Naturally, they feel compelled to let me in on them, and I appreciate the input because I always think they will work, and I'm just fooled by the people who make them work. The thing is that the particular issue, and it is a sensitive issue, and it's one we discussed at length because it's sensitive, is this issue of, should I verify a credit card before I let someone online? And the story is, watch out for chargebacks. If you get too many chargebacks, you're going to lose your vendor account and all that. My point is, if you let a person on instantaneously without verifying their credit card, you haven't had a transaction with your bank. You've had a transaction with your customer. There is no difference in your relationship with your merchant account if you let every customer on immediately and then in the privacy of your own time do the verification procedure and find out that two-thirds of them are bogus and go away. There is nothing that online verification can do for you that you can't do manually when you verify offline later, except if a credit card is declined, online verification will keep the user from ever getting that 20 minutes of free time. Your relationship with your bank is no different if you let people on instantly or if you make the machine verify them, because that isn't where the relationship with your bank occurs. It occurs when you take the credit card number and turn it into a charge to the bank, however you do that. And if you do that 3 days later by picking up the phone and dialing it, or if you do it instantly online with your computer, nothing is different. And we had a big discussion going over here about it, and there just wasn't apparently any way to get that point across. The transaction with your bank is no different. The transaction with your customer is very different. Now, the other question was a wall of comfort. To some degree, and I suppose this is a point worth mentioning, the type of system you run, the theme you have picked, and the clientele you're trying to attract can make a difference as to how trustworthy you think they are. Obviously, if you're running a sex chat bulletin board, or if you're running a download board, or if you're running a model railroading board, you're likely to be attracting three fairly different groups of people. You're after different types of people. And to some degree, there are certain types of people you might be going after where a bit more caution might be in order. And I'm not saying don't do that, use a little prudence, but I am saying once again, tune that wall to make it as easy for your customer to give you money as you possibly can. And that's the best way to do it.
Let me add a couple things to that. What you're trying to avoid doing is a very common mistake, and again it goes back to this, I can make a rule and something will go away, and it never does. You're trying to put the 2% or the 1.5% to get them, put the whole rest of the population through the hoop. And you're inconveniencing them, it's going to cause a certain loss there. The other thing is declined transactions really aren't viewed as a negative. Chargebacks are. But just simply we clear our credit card charges electronically at Boardwatch Magazine. We get a printout immediately. This was declined over and over. I've jumped up and said, why they cheated me. What they really did was put in two digits transposed. I called them on the telephone. They read it off again. Here's the two digits swapped. And it was simply a case of a fumbled keyboard. And it happens over and over again.
And the other issue is, what if they're giving you someone else's credit card number? They've learned somebody else's credit card number and they're giving it to you. The answer is, when you do the transaction with the bank, you will get a verification number, or you won't. If you did it instantly online, if you did it 3 days later offline, in fact, if you do it 3 days later offline, you're more likely to catch a stolen card. It's had more time to get in the system. On the other hand, if he just got the number, he gave it to you, this is his first abuse of the card, it's going to clear. You're going to get a verification number, and you're going to get a chargeback later. And there's nothing you can do about it. There's no process you can go through that will prevent it.
We might cover briefly a couple of the other things that are going on that are interesting. Keep in mind, there are frills around the edges. The credit card, MasterCard and Visa primarily, is the medium of exchange online. There are some interesting experiments going on with a bit of a revisit to 900-976 numbers. They usually are something on the order of a transaction charge rather than a per minute charge. You don't run a bulletin board system on a 976 line, but dial a 976 or a 900 number to get some sort of a password that a transaction fee of $8 or something is charged, then you enter that into the bulletin board system. They tend to be a little bit complex at this point, and again, the problem is the telephone companies and their relationship to 900-976. We ran an article about Sprint. We had a fella in the office explaining to us how they were now doing it at $400 sign up and would do this and would do that. 3 weeks later, they were backing off of all of that. It was all different now. So they're very confused. We're doing some work right now with Ameritech. It looks like perhaps a pilot program in Illinois where they would have a number, not a 976, but like it, where it would be a penny and a half or 2 cents higher than the normal toll rates within Illinois. The bulletin board operator would get 2.5 to 3 cents of that and so forth. But they're very much in the formative stages. They're interesting. These are things we need to look at in the future. Right now, I don't have any cases of bulletin board systems that have, in a substantial fashion, turned this into a paying thing. I think there's some things going on, but right now it's still MasterCard and Visa. We've got two people here at the show, Tim Pfeiffer with Teleflora, who's done several bulletin board systems experimentally. I think they're ready to expand that. They basically do credit cards for florists, and he subscribed to a couple of bulletin board systems, became interested in it. And another gentleman here, Bill Louder, who's has a similar company. I think we can talk to him. Another sort of fascinating area, a company I've followed for 2 years, American Digital. They're going to be out on the exhibit floor tomorrow. They do software that lets you clear those credit card charges electronically, produce reports, and he can probably tell you more than anybody about how to avoid some of these problems with callers who have transposed digits or who are using someone else's credit card. They've got a lot of experience. They've been doing this software. I know of our first story on them was 2.5 years ago. They're going to be here and in the booth. So there's some interesting things going on, but this is something you need to do to run a bulletin board system successfully.
For those of you who are interested in the 900-976 transaction charge sort of billing, there is a session in which that is discussed by some people who are actively putting those kind of schemes together. They're obviously the people who are closest to what's going on right this instant. Mm-hmm. And should anything have changed recently to make that more likely to work, I'm sure they'll be real aware of it. So if that's something you have interest in, you might want to mark that session.
Yeah. Scott?
In essence, though, the key is if somebody wants to cheat you with a credit card, you're going to get a chargeback. Try with your theme, with your image, with your presentation to make them not want to cheat you. It isn't really too difficult. People don't cheat their friends. If you look like a friend, they'll be much less likely to cheat you. It's really a lot simpler than it seems, and it has nothing to do with technology. It has to do with thinking about your callers, thinking about your system, thinking about your position in the universe, their position in the universe, and your job is to make them want to be where you are. If they want to be there, they won't want to cheat you, because if they cheat you, you won't let them back. They know that. If they really want to be there, why would they cheat you? That's the dynamic that protects you from credit card fraud more than anything else.
Well,
I think that wraps it up. There's just a few things I tail on with the comments that we got during the break, and I really felt I wanted to address that so that everybody felt that those issues had been had really been covered, because there seemed to be some uncertainty about them. Stable of Liberty says that BICS allows people to log on and use the service without validating. And they have an exposure for connect time, which means they do lose. They pay the phone bill. So if somebody steals time from them, they're out hard cash. They still feel it works better for them to allow people on without the validation and do the validation later. The question is, what was the bad debt ratio? Steve didn't give a number, but is willing to admit that it's probably not so bad as to stop the practice of letting people on without validation.
It's certainly less than the business we would lose if we locked them on.
The answer is real straightforward, as Steve gave. It's less than the business he would lose if he made them wait. And that was my point right from the start. Okay.
There are some other areas. Mostly what we focused on here has been subscription bulletin board systems. I think that's the model that's been working the best. There is a special category, the chat systems, because of the line loading function that they have, where people dial in on Sunday night and stay till late Wednesday. They have a special problem, and they have played with the hourly charges in the 50 cent to a dollar an hour range. Some of that works. The thing you have to be careful of here is not only convenience for the callers, but convenience for the SysOp. If your costs, and these are a lot of SysOps don't look at this very critically at first because it's their own personal time. But if your cost and effort to collect this money and track how many credits or how many minutes they get online for an incremental cost of if you're charging 6 cents a minute and tracking the minutes, it'll probably cost you a quarter a minute to track them. So you have to keep a constant eye on what it costs you to process an order, to give somebody that credit online based on what you're getting back from them. There is a point of diminishing returns where you can be killed by success. The system starts to work, and you have to start paying somebody to help you do this. And now you're actually paying people to be online. This is not a good trend to go for in the pursuit of profitability.
Right. And by the way, if you're looking to make your system work well and make money and become a business and generate income, you almost certainly will end up with employees. Most of the big boards we've seen that go forward reach that point, and they do end up employing people. We're just, in fact, talking over the last day or so to some of the success stories from our last seminar, and one of the things I heard most frequently was, well, I've reached a point where I had to hire somebody now.
Mm-hmm.
So they've not only quit their job, made their BBS support them, now they've created a job. But in that process, that person's time is not free. And if your structure, as Jack said, costs you more to collect the money than you collect, it's tough to make it up on volume.
A brief mention, there are some things, we're interested in them. I can't point to a lot of case histories, but there are a few systems. One thing that is working, and I think it's got a lot of promise, it's a lot of work, aside from subscription bulletin board systems and chat systems, is online sales. In theory, if you take most of the costs of running a mail order business have to do with inventory and labor. And most of the labor is someone to answer the telephone and to repeat three or four times an address and key it into a computer. If you can get the person who wants to make the purchase to key it in for you, that eliminates a lot of the labor costs. Some of these systems that we're seeing have also done away with some of the inventory and are essentially in dropship relationships with larger suppliers. What's a good example? There's a system in California that does CD-ROMs. Compact audio discs. You go into any disc store, they have what? 6,000 titles, 7,000 titles. How many can they stock? He's got 48,000 in a database. You can order them online, make them show up in your mailbox with your keyboard, and do it again on a MasterCard or Visa. He's probably got the beginnings of a good thing there.
I can tell you that Jack can testify, by the way, that that works. I was over at his house the other day and saw the stack of CD-ROMs come in.
I don't like, the reason I'm hot on this may not work at all, but I just kind of like it. Because I don't like to go into stores, wait in line for the privilege of dealing with someone there at the cash register who inevitably my driver's license or my credit card or something isn't right, I don't look right, we have this thing, they have the bag, the whole thing. if I can get on a keyboard and make something show up in the chair across from my office, I really like that power, that sense of control. And I didn't go anywhere, I didn't park anywhere, and I don't have to know anybody. So we're seeing some systems in office supplies, compact audio discs. I think it's a promising area for the future. I don't know a whole lot of systems that have made it big. You still have to promote your system. And so there is that area of it. Final area, way out in the future. I'd love to see it happen. I think it will happen at some point, but it's a hard sell right now. And that is essentially advertising-supported bulletin board systems. Ultimately, with these themes and special topics, you're going to do about what BoardWatch has done. Create a special topic or a focused market that someone is going to love to have access to. At this point, it's very difficult to sell that to people that it could actually do some good for. So we're going to watch that in the future. Right now, it's a little embryonic, I think.
Okay. The last issue that we have to cover in our plan of how to go about it, you've got your theme. You know what you're about. You've got your focus. You've gone over your board top to bottom. You've gotten rid of the things that fight your theme. You've added the things that complement your theme. You know who you are now. You know who your system is. You know what you want your callers to think of you. You've reoriented all the messages, all the help files, everything on your system now adds to that theme. Everything that tore your theme down has been taken away. You've created a nice, warm, fuzzy access for the new caller. They touch your board, something shows up in their mailbox, they call back, you take their credit card number and incidentally their money, and they're on your system as a subscriber. Now that they're on, they get all the feelings you wanted them to. You've tuned that to perfection. There's one last piece, and that's promoting your bulletin board.
Absolutely.
Now, I don't know of anywhere that I've ever seen in business people more afraid of spending 50 cents to make a dollar than I see in promoting BBSs. I've seen bulletin boards think about putting a classified ad in the newspaper and say that's going to cost me $25. I don't know if I should do it. If you're going to get $10 a subscription and that ad gets you 3 subscriptions, you were stupid not to do it. How are people going to stumble across your board if you don't let them know where it is? I don't know if you've checked the mathematical permutations, but there's a lot of phone numbers in this country. And the odds of people accidentally dialing your phone number at the same time they have a modem and a computer connected to their phone are pretty slim. I'll promote my partner's magazine here momentarily, but an ad in BoardWatch, if you want to promote your bulletin board, is an extremely, extremely profitable thing to do. If your bulletin board has met all the other criteria, if once people touch it, they're prepared to stick, an ad in BoardWatch is not only free, Jack will pay you to put it in. Actually, he'll let your callers pay you to put it in.
Aside from the BoardWatch plug, promotion is a part of any business. And again, we've been saying that the bulletin board system, if you want it to be a business, you have to run it like one. Now, there are some creative things you can do that are sort of guerrilla marketing type things to try to keep those promotion costs low. We covered the direct mail piece pretty carefully. Most of the avenues that you're going to try to advertise in, the problem, of course, is what percentage of the people you're reaching have a modem. You can increase that with, I've seen a number of systems work deals with local computer stores, put flyers in the stores or to give away something every modem they sell. There's certainly something to be said for having contact with user groups in your area, maybe sponsoring. I know Canada Remote System has a very active program of training people to use modems and the technology. They'll have an open house. People can come in and actually do this sort of thing. So there are some creative ways to do it. Unlike most businesses in the world, you also have access to the electronic network. Now, it's not what most people consider it. Yeah, there's 10 million people online in the country. The problem, of course, is they're all in groups of 35. And there's a lot of groups that you have to hit. One of the sensitive areas here is one system taking advantage of another one to advertise their service. The way around this, and it gets into the positive attitude and contribute to the community thing that somehow always works for those who practice it, is do something. compile a BBS list for your area. That's a lot of work, but it'll bring your system a lot of attention. Host a conference and moderate it and put some work in it that travels nationally, that's on a particular topic. It gets the name and the number of your bulletin board system out there while you're really contributing something to that community. So that sort of thing is a way you can promote at minimal cost. Ultimately, as this matures, you're going to have to go out and market your system just as you would a hardware store. So most of the bulletin board operators initially up to this point, and when they start out, all the money goes back into getting the next line, getting the next modem. At some point, it's going to be a competitive business, and you're going to have to go out and promote it.
I think at this point, we'd like to move to questions and answers, and we'll drive the rest of this presentation in response to your questions. What I'd like to be sure is that we do this in as organized a fashion as possible. We'll take the questions, we'll repeat the questions so that they go on the audio tape, and then we'll try to avoid chaotic back and forth as much as possible, because none of that will be on the tape when we're done. So I thought I saw a hand right here first, so if you go ahead.
You were talking about establishing a sense of place for your bulletin board, and along with that, do you feel that if you start off as a quote hobby board and then try and generate it as a business, are you disrupting that sense of place? If your ultimate goal is to have a business, should you start it out that way?
Well, there's actually two questions there. The first question is, if you start out as a hobby board and then want to convert it to a subscription service and a user-supported board, are you disturbing things? And the other is, if you want to start a user subscription board, should you start it as a hobby board? And those really are somewhat separate questions. The answer is that many, many successful boards started as hobby boards. The conversion process is a bit ticklish, but handled well, it can be very successful. You can use your experience as a hobby board to establish that sense of place. You're very free to experiment. You're very free to see what people respond to and learn about BBSs in general. When you make the conversion, you will lose a certain percentage of the people. The other percentage will be probably happy that you did this, and they've gotten their place that they can pay a little money to be in. And it really works out both ways. Then you can grow from there, now based on your experience that you've learned determining who you are and what you're really doing. The other question, which is should you start that way, I would say is much more problematic. I think it's really up to how you feel. The answer is you can be successful starting either way.
Yeah, the other thing is the part about it being your goal to run a BBS as a business. Now, I think there's some opportunities there, but again, I'd go back to what Bob Mahoney said. We need a more complex set of goals here. And a lot of times, what you're interested in and the direction you're taking will be infectious among your callers. A certain amount of them will want to be along for the ride. A certain amount of them will move on to something else. But I don't think that it's particularly a problem. I'd focus on that mission and what your goal is aside from making money. Most of the people whose goal in the world is to make money don't do a very good job of that. If they're doing something else and run things prudently and as a business, usually the world will give you your crust of bread if it's a worthy goal or ideal. So I'd focus on that. The other thing that comes up, and this is the hidden secret of bulletin boards, that a lot of them just don't give up. It's cute. I like it. It has its own certain irony. But basically, the systems we watch that have agonized over this going pay issue, and this is going back a couple of years ago when it really was an issue, the going pay and I'm going to lose all my callers and we're not going to have an active system anymore. Basically, they did lose some callers. They lost 20 to 30% of their callers. They also lost 80 to 90% of their problems. Most of the people that are really there for a free ride wouldn't think of supporting you in what you're doing cause a lot of effort on your part, an inordinate amount of effort based on their numbers. It's not always bad news to lose a caller. Some callers it's best to send to the competing board across the street. And I've recommended some.
A question back here.
Is it better to, when you're doing a BBS for profit, charge them a flat rate or a monthly rate?
question is it better to charge a flat, by that I assume you mean annual rate or a monthly rate or a quarterly rate? The answer is all of those are far better than the by the minute, by the hour, by the piece rates. Unless you have some section of your board that's just incredibly popular, selling it as a piece by the hour is probably the worst thing you can do.
And we get back into what's the administrative cost of tracking them monthly as opposed to tracking them quarterly or yearly. My approach is to keep it as simple as possible. Our system has one fee, it's for a year, and we have to keep track of less, it's easier to increment. I have to tell you that many of the successful bulletin board systems, Brian and Tess with up in Cambridge with Channel 1, I know that Neil Fleming and Judd Newell with Canada Remote Systems have fairly complex schedules of the different ways you can access the system. But they all seem to revolve around quarterly or annual charges for some fixed amount of daily access. That's the model that's emerging that seems to be working.
There's two reasons that going at least quarterly or longer makes sense, and that is, if you remember that you're selling entertainment, a lot of it's impulse buy, a lot of people will come, get interested, subscribe, and after a month or two, go on. If you've had them pay for 3 months, when they started, whenever they leave, you end up with a bit more money than you were going to get otherwise. The tuning point to that is, if you're going to charge more than a certain amount per year, breaking it up into quarterly makes the charge each time smaller. You're dealing with an emotional threshold of when will I pop for this much money. If it's $200 a year, that may not be the best to have that as your only purchase option. You probably want something in the $20 to $30 range that they can buy, because that's kind of a psychological point.
This is something I call it the Vic Taney situation. Vic Taney had a series of health clubs. If everyone showed up in the parking lot at the same time it was a member, you wouldn't be able to park in the city. Likewise, on our system, if everyone dialed in at the same time, it'd probably blow two COs, much less our system. But it's not really, you can be very upfront about this and explain to them how it's going to go. I've got one person who's been on that system 4 times in 4 years, each time to renew. I actually called him on the telephone and said, no, you don't understand, you can have the magazine, you don't even need the BBS access, I love to have the money, but basically I think we've got a misunderstanding here, I'm going to refund this amount, you're going to get the magazine, you never call the bulletin board, you don't need it. He said, no, I wanted the bulletin board. I said, you call 4 times in 4 years, and the only time you call, he said, I paid for it, it's mine, I can come when I want to, that's my business. Okay. And he's right. It's not any of my business how often he calls. So there is some of that. But keep it simple, both to keep your own administrative costs low and to keep them from going off into a 3-day sabbatical to make a decision.
Okay, over here. The question is, can you make some relationship between the number of lines on a bulletin board and how profitable it's likely to be? Jack, you've done some numbers on
that. Actually, we've been putting together quite a bit of effort in that area. I got to tell you, it's pretty preliminary at this point. We're not detecting a whole lot of critical curves across profitability and the number of lines. There are some technical breakpoints that people seem to stumble on their lands and so forth. We have found some interesting relationships, and I'm almost hesitant to share them at this point, but why not? You're all here.
It's all on tape. You can hold it against us later.
Right. There is no system, by the way, that follows this model. This is a composite of data that individual sysops have shared with us. But the number that's come up, and it's a magic number, is $84.50. and it really is a magic number. We can take that and multiply it by the per dollar amount of an annual subscription to generate a per line annual figure of what you can expect to make on a line. If you do $40 annual subscription, you multiply 40 times the $84.50. Right now it seems to be coming up about $4,250 per year on a single line. It appears at this point, and we've still got to do some work on both ends, but across the middle from about 8 lines up through 40-50 lines, we're pretty sure that this works out pretty much flat across the lines. So if you charge $30, obviously you're going to be down in the $3,200, $3,300 range, $40, a little bit higher. $50 comes in about $4,250, if I remember it right. It's pretty simple math, 50 times 84.50, whatever that is. That's what you've got to work with when you go to add a line or you want to expand your system by a line. You can calculate that as being a rough rule of thumb of what that line is going to generate if you do everything else right. We've got systems that are higher than that. We've got some that are lower than that. But that's what we're working on a rule of thumb is $84.50 per dollar per year for one line. And it seems to hold true through the mid-range of 8 to maybe 40 lines.
The one thing to remember about that dynamic is that chat systems have a very different dynamic.
Yes.
Because they have a minimum critical mass. If you've got a two-line chat system...
Right.
I guess I don't have to finish this explanation. It seemed to be obvious. On the other hand, a two-line download system can generate money.
Yeah, but the figures we're working on are basically from the 6 to 8 line range and up. I think they might hold true pretty much for a 4 or 6 line system, but I can't really document that.
Okay. You want to pick the next one here?
Yeah, let's go right here.
Where do you find it profitable to expand the number of lines you have?
Where do you find it profitable to expand the number of lines you have? Well, now we're getting into an area of some of the harsh realities that telephone companies, commercial services, and bulletin board systems have to deal with, and that is peak load. We are actually, in the last year or so, seeing more of a move into the afternoon and the morning, and we think it's people at work on bulletin boards on company time, but the evening hours are still primarily the 7 to 10 time frame is it. One of the things you run into is that all of your subscriptions, aside from the renewals, are from new callers. If you have people who have paid on your system downloading files and all the lines are full, at that point there is no more money. Okay? So you need to be able to have the system to be able to have new callers coming in during peak periods, and the more you can do to offset that, the better off you are. The big challenge, of course, is if you take that $4,250, you only get that after you pay the what we're basically looking at is $1,500 in hardware costs, another $500 in programming, telephone, file acquisition, some contribution to your file server, and so forth. You pay that before you get any of the rest of it. For some time, we had bulletin board operators who were making money and didn't know it. Their lines were actually generating a profit, but they were plowing it back in so fast to get more lines that at the end of the year they had 40 lines and couldn't order pizza. They thought they weren't making any money. By the way, most entrepreneurs in the country who you could show them something that had 6 telephone lines at one day in the year, 40 at the other one, and didn't generate any cash would be looking for 12 or 15 of them to snap up. It didn't pay any taxes, it's funding its own growth, and it's growing very rapidly. That is, by the way, making money, even if they didn't have $100 bills hanging out of their pockets at the end of the year. Let's go over here.
This will either help this company or expose them, but I want to ask you a question, anybody else in the audience. There's a company called MasterLink that's passing this paper out. People who have a credit card, or want to get a credit card and can't get an account, evidently you can use their account. Mm-hmm. First of all, is that legal?
Question is, there's a company passing around a flyer called MasterLink where they will process credit card charges. And the question is that legal? The answer is a little bit complex. I don't know anything about this company at this point. I know we have several people here doing that. There are third-party aggregators who market merchant accounts. Now, the way this usually works, most of them we've seen, is like this. You can't get an account at the local bank. You can't get it at any price. You can't post a bond. You can't talk him into it. So you go to one of these third-party service providers. They take a $200 terminal, lease it to you for $48 at 60 bu- or 48 months at $60 a month. That's where they make their money. They set you up with a bank on a network to do this. Yes, that's legal. Now, someone else who has a business and has a business account who is going to process your credit cards through their account and you don't really have one, that gets into a grayer area. And normally it's not a matter of being legal or illegal, it's a matter of their agreement with their bank being contra to the contract.
And in most cases, merchant accounts make that specifically against the contract. You have breached your contract if you clear someone else's charge through your merchant account. But again, that's specifically a contractual agreement that's part of everybody's merchant account. I suppose, and since a contract's a contract and every contract can be negotiated, somebody might be able to negotiate a merchant account that allows that. But if so, they've done a lot of talking to their banker. And most do not.
Yeah, I'd want to see something from someone like that about their relationship with that bank, if they're simply processing your charges through it. There are legitimate third-party people who will set you up with an account. Some of them are reliable, some not. I know that a couple of them we've got here to the show, we seem to have had good success. The first question I'd ask, do you do any other bulletin boards? What's their telephone number? You want to pick one?
Let's go back over here. How about back here? The question is about a BBS that's only partly subscription. That is, has a certain percentage of the BBS that's free access to anyone who calls, and then certain added features which they subscribe to. That's a perfectly valid method of marketing. Again, you have to remember your focus is to come up with a structure that encourages enough people to buy the part you're selling. What you're really doing is using the free part of your board as part of this theme, attract it, establish your sense of place, make people like you, make people want to be there, and then you're their friend selling them the extra stuff that they want. If you can make that work well enough, that's a valid method of marketing. Each way of approaching this has its own trade-offs, and again, you've just got to analyze each thing you do. Can you generate enough cash flow from doing that? But it's absolutely valid. It's the same as free samples in any other business.
In fact, it's very common among bulletin boards to do so, so much so that's one of the things I look for is the difference between a bulletin board system and a commercial online service run by a corporation somewhere. Most of the bulletin boards you can dial in, at least get information about the system and how to subscribe with a modem without a pre-made voice telephone call. Most of the successful bulletin board systems, you can actually dial in, download at least a list of files, look around and see what message areas are available. They'll usually have a time limit, sort of a secret number some of the bulletin board operators have thrown around. How good it is, I don't know. I don't even know how to test it. It's about 20 to 25 minutes of free time per call, and then anything over that is charged for. But if you get people on there, they find it interesting, they see what you like, and they like it, that's a good time to hit them for a subscription. Right up here?
At what point is it worthwhile to look at getting an X25 pad or ICM connection?
Question is, what point is it worth looking at getting an X25 or an ISDN connection? Personal feeling, at this point, there is no such time.
Yeah. I've seen more bulletin board operators taken to the cleaners over X25 than anything there is. Now this gets to something that, you know, I don't know where part of it's coming from, but it's the game to beat the long distance service. The long distance costs have come down 40% in the 8 years since divestiture. It's not really that significant a cost anymore. In that contest we held this year, we found that 27% of the people voting for their favorite bulletin board system were dialing a different area code from the one they were calling from. And we can't tell and don't have any visibility what percentage of those were within the same area code that were long distance. And in some areas like Chicago and Washington, D.C., everything is. So the long distance charge is not the dissuader many of the old-time bullet board operators thought it was. So to put in superhuman efforts to defeat it, and the superhuman efforts usually run anywhere from $9 to $1,500 a month for the base charge plus airtime, then you have to collect for that. I have not seen X25, touch bulletin board systems that are run for profit, and it make any sense at all. In fact, it's been damaging to some systems and it brought some otherwise profitable systems to their knees. X25 for a company system that wants their sales reps in different towns to have a local access number and not have to charge long distance call. Whole different game. We're talking about bulletin board systems for profit that you want the caller the best game going for long distance costs. It's a residential calling plan dialed at night by them. 800 numbers, everything else you pay a premium for, and you have to pass that along to your callers somehow, some way, sometime. Over here.
You mentioned the 20-minute figure for the online time. Have you found anything optimum in terms of incentives to give new callers, like access to some bulletin boards that people come on for 2 months free access? Others will only let you look at the free files list. Are you aware of any optimum combination of incentives?
Question is are we aware of any optimum combination of new user enticements such as free time, free downloads, access to file system? Is there some tuning that's the perfect tuning? I think the answer to that is clearly no. It's very dependent on your system, your theme, your purpose. Each theme, each reason you're doing things will generate its own optimum new user enticement. Your purpose, again, is just to get new callers to know who you are and to care.
The ultimate thing of this, and there are some things you can observe online that are common, but ultimately you have to test. And this is an area that is extremely frightening to me. We've got an entry on our menu on the BoardWatch bulletin board system that says subscribe to BoardWatch magazine, and it has a key you can press to do that. During a maintenance function, we change that to enter subscription to BoardWatch magazine. Two-thirds of the people that were subscribing online that we were doing each week went away. I didn't know if it was a hurricane, if part of the country had been wiped out of telephone service, what had happened, but for the next 2 weeks, we did about a third of what we'd been doing on a weekly basis in subscriptions. We went back and went through the records, what had this done, what did it mean, changed it back to subscribe to BoardWatch magazine, and came up precisely to the level we were at before. What's the difference? Somebody tell me. Between enter a subscription to BoardWatch magazine and subscribe to BoardWatch magazine.
I would say it's about 1/3 of your subscriptions a month.
That's right. That's about it exactly. And the only way we know about it is we accidentally tested it. This brings up the question of what else am I doing wrong? So the idea is to experiment there and to track the results as carefully as you can, because very small changes on those menus and that solicitation to subscribe and that online offer of the free 20 minutes a day and so forth, tiny increments could make a tremendous difference in the bottom line, at the end, and based on I couldn't tell you what.
But
you
again,
try
that,
something,
that points
test
out,
it, try it again.
Again, that points out how individualistic each system is and how sensitive tuning your system to what your callers expect to see is. My suspicion is they were calling to subscribe. And when they didn't see subscribe on the left-hand column of the menu, they left.
Could be that simple. Again, it gets back to your theme, tone, and mission and the audience you're catering to. Dan Linton over here.
Theory being that you buy your way out of busy signals. That's the purpose of member-only lines. The question is that a viable incentive? I've seen it work real well in some cases and not in others. And again, it's like Jack said about the menu thing, it's hard to say. It seems like a reasonable thing to experiment with.
Yeah, it does. I've seen systems do it. I didn't have access to how it was working for them as opposed to not. One of the things that gave bulletin board systems for pay its start was the freedom from busy signals. Initially, everyone wants bulletin boards to be free. And after about 60 days online, they want them to be right now. And they want to get out of the busy signals. So it makes sense, but I've got to tell you, most of the large successful bulletin board systems in operation aren't fooling with it. So I think it's probably the ultimate answer there. And again, test it, but I'm going to guess it's more trouble than it pays out. go back here. Sure.
In attention to some of the other questions, what do you feel about different classes of membership? For instance, perhaps commercial versus non-commercial, or restricted access, or such?
Yeah, I...
Question is, what about different classes of membership?
I personally don't like them, because they make it complicated for you to administer and they give your callers more of a decision to make. I want to defer that one, though, to a conference we're going to have on subscriber bulletin board systems, and that is 8:14 at 16:30, is that it? BBS Success Roundtable is where I want him to go.
8:14 at 1500.
We're going to have Brian Miller and Tess Hedder, who are the king of having a very complicated different classes, commercial, student, part-time, an hour a day, 2 hours a day, 4 meg a day, and so forth. Neil Fleming will be at that session. He's going to be on that panel. Norm Hinkey, I don't remember if I told him that, but he's going to be on that one. And several of these people do have varying levels of complexity in that type of thing, and I think you could pose that question to them probably more profitably than us.
That's right. Those specific sort of things, if you look in your program guide on page 16, you'll see the How to Make Money with a BBS track. And this are all of our ancillary sessions we've put together. In this case, we have two or three different sessions, which are roundtables with actual SysOps who are doing it. So the kind of questions like this one, Jack and I are secondhand on this. We talk to SysOps and we kind of collate what we hear. It's also probably very useful to get the opinions of those who've actually done it and either had wild success or they changed something on their menu and watched their money dry up and then put it back and saw it come back and have tested and know what does work and what doesn't.
We did something similar to this at a PhytoCon 91 last year. It was very successful. A number of the people that came to it went out, did things, came back and told us about it. What that really inspired us to do is instead of doing 2 hours and sending you out in the street, we put a lot of work into putting together a track with people that are doing it up on the stage where you can find out more information about a business plan, more information about dealing with the press to promote your bulletin board system, more information from the people who are doing this for a living and running successful bulletin board systems. So I think we've got a much more extensive thing. Some of this that we've said today may sound familiar to some of you. We've actually gone to a lot of work to expand it, bring in people that can back this up with more detailed data, more information, and a lot more real-world experience called over the last year, and I think it's going to be a good program.
The other thing is that I'd like to say we're almost out of time right now, and I'd like to put one little piece of motivational ending on all of this. Don't overanalyze what you're doing before you start doing it. The only true way to figure out what works is to try things. Don't be afraid to put up a BBS, try it, get feedback, experiment. You can sit here, talk to us, talk to experts until you try to find the perfect plan, and you'll watch everyone else make money with a BBS. You've got to start something to get anywhere. If you make a move and then another move after that, each move can be very tiny and you'll travel a great distance. If you sit until you're convinced you know exactly the right move to make, you'll sit forever. And that is really the thing I'd like to put on. I said this last year and a lot of people said that really this was the kick that got them to try this stuff even though they didn't think it would work. A lot of them are back here stopping me in the hall thanking us for how well we did last year at getting them to make money this year. So talk to these people, go through our sessions we have put together for you to detail some of these things, but it really is very simple. Get a theme, know who you are, know who you want for callers, make a place that will attract them, make it easy to take their money willingly, spend it in good health.
About to get through this day, believe it or not.
Do we have anything tonight that's hot? I was thinking we don't actually have anything like dinners or No,
receptions.
I
think it's the only night we don't, and that's why I'm feeling weird. Like, is it really true?
Speakers meeting at 6.
That's it.
Dvorak's going to do their award thing. Maybe some parties in there.
We need to, like, move out to the hall because
we do.
Awards in here instantly, so we've got to clear.
Well, I need to give a piece of advice from
you. Absolutely. We just got to get out in the hall.